Welcome to Your Cases on Hold, a JBJS podcast hosted by Antonia Chen and Andrew Schoenfeld.
Here, we discuss the science of each issue of JBJS with an additional dose of entertainment and pop culture.
Take us with you in the gym, on the commute, or most certainly, whenever your case is on hold.
Welcome back to another episode of Your Case is on Hold number 58. We are in the middle May here representing. Hopefully you're enjoying the warmer weather if you live in a colder climate. And the spring has sprung and the world around you looks beautiful. I'm Antonia Chen. I'm deputy editor of Adult Reconstruction, and I have here...
I'm Andrew Schoenfeld, deputy editor for Methods.
Of note, these opinions are of our own and not of anyone else at the JBJS or the JBJS board or any of the staff members of JBJS. This is brought to you, though, by JBJS CME. There's plenty of continuing medical education credits, maintenance of certification, different methods to get your credits on and your education on. So please feel free to look at more and check out what you've got at JBJS. Without stopping, let's start at the top of the pile. What's new in foot and ankle surgery by Hembree, and it is permanently free. I love these updates. They give you a lot of good information over the last few years. There's three evidence-based orthopedic articles. What's important? The Journal of Bone and Joint Surgery, a critical pillar of our field by Swentowski. And we wanted to say thank you, Dr. Swentowski, for all your leading efforts as the editor-in-chief and doing a wonderful job. And we'll be bringing on Mo Bendari soon as our next editor-in-chief.
This is the last issue where Dr. Swentowski is the editor-in-chief. Starting in June, Dr. Bendari will be the editor-in-chief, but obviously there'll be a tail of issues that were prepared by Dr. Swentowski because there's probably like a 2 or 3 month lead-up time to prepare issues. So anyway.
A little bit of cross-pollination there, which is always nice. Best Practices for Developing International Academic Partnerships in Orthopedics by Brown. This is also permanently free. Limitations of Minimal Clinically Important Difference Estimates and Potential Alternatives by Riddle. And now we're going to go on to the headlines. Tell us about heated tobacco products having detrimental effects on rotator cuff healing similar to conventional cigarettes by Yoon. And there's an infographic and a commentary.
Yeah, so interesting study here. I think certainly where we are and maybe universally, I do remark that you see fewer and fewer people who are actually smoking, but a lot of people who are vaping. So these authors from Korea wanted to look at the effects of vaping products, heated tobacco products, on rotator cuff healing as opposed to conventional cigarettes. I mean, getting at, kind of the more singular effect of nicotine and maybe other chemicals that would be in the vape versus the smoke and other issues present when, basically inhaling from a combustible cigarette. So they had a cohort of patients collected over a 10-year time window of over 1,000 patients, and they broke these down into non-smokers, cigarette smokers, and heated tobacco smokers. Now, obviously, the prevalence of heated tobacco use is going to be more aligned with later time points in this study, which does introduce prospect for secular trends. When you look at their table one, they have almost 1,000 non-smokers, which I guess may be a cultural thing. And also, again, if you did this study in 1990, there'd probably be a whole lot of more smokers. They had a little bit over 150 smokers, but only 45 heated tobacco users. So to adjust for this, they did propensity score matching, which is a causal inference test, as we discussed. I don't love the approach for a couple of reasons. One, when you do causal inference testing, the whole premise is that you're trying to basically, get at sort of the unmeasured confounders that are present. Generally, the way it's constructed is around decisions for treatment or something to that effect. A lot of times, you'll see people want to advertise causal inference testing as, simulating a randomized trial, right? They'll use that verbiage. You're simulating a randomized trial of rotator cuff repair versus non-operative treatment, or total knee arthroplasty versus unicondylar arthroplasty, right? Treatment A versus treatment B, accounting for the confounding by indication. Now, that doesn't mean it always has to be used that way, but that's the best way in which it is generally applied. So the first thing here is that this would kind of be like you took patients who had rotator cuff, and, like, you randomized them to be non-smokers, smokers, or vape users. Yeah, I mean, you know, what you're trying to model off of the propensity score is the propensity to be a vape user, right? In this context. But when you look at their clinic, their tables, their tables don't have the things that drive people to use vape pens or smoke cigarettes. These are all clinical things. They're all things around the rotator cuff, age, sex. Obviously, those aren't clinical things. Those are sociodemographic things. But dominance, duration of symptoms, onset after trauma, are they diabetic? Like, none of these things go into if they're smoking or not. So they're sort of using the propensity score as kind of a stand-in for basically just a regression. It's just you're trying to adjust for these other factors and how they might relate, but they actually are not drivers themselves of the primary predictor variable. And that will detract from some of, like, the real potential impact that a propensity score can have. So in this case, it's sort of just like a stand-in for a regression test. Second, when you do propensity score matching, you have to have the index case, and then you have to have somebody that looks relatively like them. And that's going to be based off of the caliper. When you only have 45 patients who are vapers or heated tobacco product user, that's going to really restrict the potential number. You have to find people that look just like these individuals, right? And it's just what they happen to look like. It's 45 vape users. To make the case that these individuals are somehow representative of the entire universe of vape users in Korea or elsewhere is very hard to accept, right? So my suggestion from a methodology standpoint is when you have limited numbers of patients or a confiscatory sample, you do something like weighting, because weighting will let you keep everybody. That's in smart. This case, they basically took 45 of the vape users, and then they matched 45 of the non-smokers and 45 of the tobacco users. And then everybody else is out. Like, everybody else is just cut. You didn't make the team. Sorry. Not going to be in this study. So it loses a lot of the potential power from the overall sample, because you're basically, you know, just have like these finite number of slots available. And then further, and potentially even more important, it's unusual that, like, you find 45 exact matches for 45 individuals. Usually there's a couple of patients that just for some reason or another, it doesn't work out that well, right? Like, there's just something about this person.
It's imperfect.
Right, yeah. So when you find 45 and 45, it's like, are you being a little bit too permissive in how you... You know, the propensity score is not perfect. It's just sort of a composite. So men can be matched with women, and, like, older people can be matched with younger people. Like, it's just sort of the general sense. If you imagine, like, kind of like blurring an image, it's like when you blur the images look pretty similar, right? But if you blurred an image like a whole lot, then anything is going to look very similar, right? I think that's really cool. I just came up with that analogy right now.
Like, that was perfect. Everyone heard it here. Mic drop.
Yeah. So then the next thing that's a problem is that they do this propensity score matching, which should eliminate all of the differences between the groups if it's done well. And right off the bat, they didn't succeed at doing that. Their post-match balance is out of proportion for sex at a minimum. Then they're using p-values to test for differences, which usually we recommend using standardized mean differences. And that's also a problem because they're underpowered potentially to detect differences that may be more clinically meaningful across the different cohorts. So they did find that the retail rate for non-smokers was significantly lower, 8.9% among non-smokers. The actual cigarette smokers was 31%, and it's like 29% for the heated tobacco users. Bottom line, to get to the Cliff Notes version of this, you know, basically that whether they were smokers or vapers, they pretty much look the same. The effects of the nicotine, we'll say, or whatever other chemicals may be present in the vape product are not dramatically different in this context from the effect of just smoking cigarettes. So odds that are right around 3.4 times higher or re-tear. You know, and they say abstinence from smoking is necessary for patients undergoing rotator cuff repair surgery. I don't contest that. I think the way they got there has like a lot of limitations, basically, as I enumerated for you. I think the signal is probably true and makes sense.
Yeah, I'm actually interested in the study population, if this were repeated in a different patient population, just given that I don't think the number of vapors may be as high in other places as there are some places here. So if you're looking for sample size, I think that would be something that would be much more impactful in different areas. So you know how we grow up when this is just say no to drugs or just say no to smoking. So, you know, just say no to certain methodology changes. Yeah, leave it at that.
Propensity score matching with 45 patients.
There you go. Perfect. So moving on to how to raise the bar in the capture of patient-reported outcome measures in total joint arthroplasty results from active and passive follow-up measures. This is by Rullian et al. It's free for 30 days. So for those who are not total joint connoisseurs, this is actually a very, very relevant topic at this point in time. Why is it relevant? Up until now, patient-reported outcome measures or PROMS collections in total joint arthroplasty has been fully voluntary. You just get it. Most people get it for research purposes. Some people use it to show their patients. A lot of people have been moving towards this idea of getting it more and more for more patients. But now it is becoming a CMS mandate. So the Center of Medicaid and Medicaid Medicare and Medicaid Services, starting just in April, that required total hip and total knee arthroplasty patients to have patient-reported outcome performance measures, or known as the PRO-PM, to be collected. And it needs to be collected preoperatively and then at the one-year postoperative point. So that's called a paired PROMS collection. So you have to collect both of those points, and over time, you have to hit a certain minimally clinical significant difference or significant clinical benefit of 20 for knees and 22 for hips based on the HOOS and COOS JR. Now, that said, this group said, how can we increase the ability to capture patient-reported outcome measures? And right now, it's voluntary until 2026, and it'll become mandatory in 2027 with the financial penalty if you do not collect your PROMS. The problem in the past, at one-year follow-up, a lot of our total joint patients, wonderfully enough, are doing very well. So they don't necessarily come back, and the follow-up is as low as 35% at 1 year. Now we're being mandated to collect a much higher percentage of patients to come back. So how do we get patients to return back? There's obviously a variety of ways to collect PROMS, and multiple facilities have multiple different methods of doing it. So the goals of the study were to determine follow-up rates for one-year PROMS when the follow-up was conducted with active methods, such as attempted contact by staff, as well as passive methods, which are automated methods, sending messages out, and I'll get into those details in a little bit. And then evaluate factors associated with the higher odds of requiring active follow-up and those who are being likely to be lost to follow-up in a large prospective cohort of patients, which included 7,436 elective total hip and 10,119 elective total knee arthroplasty patients between January 2016 and December 2020 in a large integrated healthcare system that relied on this orthopedic minimal data set episode of care, or an OME database. They looked at HOOS pain, HOOS pain, so hip and knee, the pain algorithm, and then HOOS PS and COOS PS and VR, specifically the mental component scores, the MCS. They didn't look at HOOS JR or COOS JR, which is what's required by CMS, but they looked at these different patient-reported outcomes, knowing that if a patient filled one out, they're more likely to fill any of them out. And they also looked at overall patient satisfaction with a total joint, and it was evaluated using a binary question to determine attainment of a patient-acceptable symptom state or past. One difference in their practice that's not necessarily translatable to all practices is that their preoperative PROMs were obtained on the day of surgery as patients were completing their preoperative check-in. So they were being checked into surgery, they were handed a tablet, and they filled out their preoperative PROM. So they definitely captured it within the time frame. That is not always the case for our patients. Sometimes a patient will come and see me, I'll get a patient at preoperative PROMs, and they might be 3 months before surgery or 6 months before surgery. They're booking much later because it's an elective procedure, so I may not capture their preoperative PROMs rate. So they made sure to capture the preoperative PROMs rate by ensuring that they were done on the day of surgery. So what is the passive collection? So the OME system automatically triggered prompts to patients inviting the completion of postoperative PROMs. They already had the preoperative PROMs, they're out of the way. They were delivered via email, text message, and the electronic medical record patient portal. Patients could complete the PROMs on any internet-connected device, such as smartphones, desktop computers, and laptop computers. And automated PROMs were sent to patients 2 or 3 times over a 3-week period to maximize response rates. If patients did not complete the PROMs after the automated prompts, the system triggered active follow-up contact by the study team. And that's when the active side kicked in. So to delineate active versus passive is not exactly right in this study. It wasn't that patients got active or passive. Everyone got passive to start off with. And if they didn't respond, then it triggered the active side of things. So active were specifically full-time staff telephone non-responders to encourage PROMs completion. If calls were unsuccessful, staff sent personalized messages, text messages, and physical mail letters to patients over a four-week active follow-up period, which takes a lot of personnel and a lot of work. And this is over 4 weeks for all the patients included in this pretty large series of patients. So the patients were considered lost to follow-up if active follow-up methods were unsuccessful after 4 weeks or patients requested not to be contacted anymore during the follow-up period. So they broke down total hips and total knees. And I think this was a previous episode of Your Case on Hold where you say, do we really need to break it down by total hips and total knees?
I was just thinking about that. Yes. Yes. It's so, like, why would the response rate be different for the hip patients and the knee patients? I mean, that was around the poor, the postoperative urinary retention. And it made more sense, although still, total hip bladder is the same as total knee bladder, but you were like, oh, the management protocols might be different. Here, there's no reason to have that breakdown.
It was 1 point difference or 1 percentage point difference. So there you go. Total hips, 79% achieved 1 year follow-up. Total knees, it was 80%. So the loss to follow-up was 19 and 20%. Passive measures were successful for approximately 40% for both, and 40% required active measures to complete follow-up. So that's how I got to the 80%. So they got the 40% passively and another 40% actively. They were both very similar about what they had. The loss to follow-up had longer length of hospital stay, were discharged home less frequently, and had a higher 90-day inpatient readmission rate after total hip. For total knees, they had longer hospital length of stay after loss to follow-up, discharged home less frequently, and had a higher 90-day readmission rate. Compared to the active group, the passive group had a higher rate of home discharge, interestingly enough, the lower 90-day inpatient readmission rate. There were no differences in the proportion of patients who achieved the pass between active and passive cohorts. So that's really not the reason why they're not responding. It's just they're not responding and they had to be chased down. And furthermore, mean 1 year WHOOS pain and KOOS pain and WHOOS PS and KOOS PS scores were similar between the active and passive group. Who are more likely to be at risk for loss to follow-up? Younger patients, male patients, Black or other race, fewer years of education, current smoking, cessation of smoking less than 6 months previously, Medicaid or Medicare insurance patients, and specific baseline PROMS phenotypes. And then for the needs for active follow-up, so some people needed to be active follow-up, there were slight differences between the hip and the knee cohort, but older age, male sex, lower body mass index, which is only the hip patients, Black race, fewer years of education for both of them, higher ADI, as well as specific baseline PROMS phenotypes. And what are those PROMS phenotypes? Patients who scored in the lower half were pain, function, and or mental health were those specific baseline PROMS phenotypes. So it does show that passive PROMS are not enough. If you want to achieve a high rate of PROMS collection, we need active input. The problem is active input is expensive. And so this was not a study looking at costs or things like that. They simply said, you want to increase your rates? Get people on board. If you chase people down enough, you'll get them to fill out their patient-reported outcomes. It would be actually interesting in this cohort of study to also look at if they achieve their MCID, right? If they achieve that 20 or 22 on the WHOOS or the KOOS, to see if that actually makes a difference in our patients and what would be predictive of that. There might be a separate study that they're going to be doing. Again, we talked about not separating hip and knee patients. And then how do we capture these other patients, right? We have a list of follow-up, you know, people who are lost to follow-up or need active follow-up. Those are nice demographic and information to know. But if you do address those preoperatively, change their BMI, things like that, will that really actually change their PROMS collection rate? Probably not, right? So what flag do we need to get people to fill it out? You know, and how do we emphasize the importance of this? And, you know, these variables are interesting, but not necessarily the ones that are going to get us across the finish line.
Yeah. I mean, I'll start off by saying, and I understand it's really not relevant, but I think this is a misguided initiative. And like many sort of blanket initiatives of this type, the idea behind it and the intent is well-meaning, but the necessary implements to affect the outcome are just really challenging, particularly since you are coupling the provider with an individual that they can't control how the patient behaves. They can't control patient behavior, right? So if the patient doesn't want to fill it out, and we've discussed this before, but for those who haven't heard previous, you know, I will tell you that if you want high levels of prompt completion, you have to have a number of factors. One, the patient, you have to have patient and provider buy-in. Now, with penalties and things like that, okay, you'll get the provider buy-in, right? You're going to force the provider buy-in. But that doesn't mean the patient doesn't necessarily have to buy in, right? So you need patient buy-in. They need to understand why it's being done and why it's important. Then, and this is still not being motivated here, they have to fill it out correctly. So what's to stop, if you couldn't get a patient to comply, what's to stop the medical assistant or somebody from just being like, okay, I'm going to fill it out for you. Great, 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 great. There it is. It's done. I did it. The patient, you know, they did it. I'm just going to fill it out for you. Okay. We'll fill everything out that you did. Awesome. The government initiative is met. Not done correctly.
You checked the boxes, done. Right. But is it actually meaningful? Right. And that's where that clinically meaningful difference, and I'm curious about if that made any difference there, because that's what you're interested in, to see if there is an impact.
Yeah. No, absolutely. From work that we've done, not trying to measure this, but just trying to get patients to complete these for research purposes, when you already have the patients agreeing to participate and understanding the importance of it, you have to have a very granular hands-on approach, which is sort of what they're doing here. I would say it has to be even more than what they're doing. I think you need something like the NISQIP, National Surgical Quality Improvement Program, has, with like dedicated nurse abstractors or you know, where they are reaching out to the patients. It's nice what you can get passively, of course, because that makes less work for your, you know, your dedicated abstraction team. But that's what's gonna have to happen. You're gonna have to have new individuals, new jobs created for these folks who are their 100% their job is just to be following up with these patients to either how can we help you get this done? Like, how can we capture this?
That's their only job.
Right. And it's a full-time job. To we'll meet up with you, you know, we'll reach out to you 30 days before your 1 year visit. It's easier to do preoperatively because there's more motivation on that front. It's after the fact that it's harder. We're going to call you about coming into the clinic. We're going to show up in the waiting room when we know that you're there with the iPad or whatever it is to like start talking about filling it out. Oh, you don't want to fill it out? Okay. You know, this motivated medical student that we have working with our team will just help you fill it out. Like those are the kinds of things that you have to do. This study, the title, all this stuff, I think there's a lot of advertising that's built in here with like this study. The title could just be, you know, what are the rates of patients who require active engagement to complete their PROMs? They're not really showing you how to raise the bar. And that, you know, innovative strategies aimed at targeting individuals. Okay. I mean, that's just quality improvement speak. What innovative strategies? I have an innovative strategy. I don't know if it's going to work or not. I think it would, but you know, they don't give you any strategies. They're just telling you that if you don't do anything in their population, which is a highly selective population, it's the Cleveland Clinic's patient population. And there are going to be certain parameters there that are not necessarily scalable to other clinical contexts. You know, when they say like something that's particularly problematic for me is Black and other non-white race. So it's basically just non-white patient, right? It's a non-white patient cohort. Like they called it Black and other non-white race, but the estimates are for everyone who wasn't identified as white. And that's just the real problem, because that's not any one particular group of people. So that's a very broad brushstroke that it is necessary in this context, because they're using a regression analysis and they don't have the volume of individuals to say amongst African-American, Black patients, Hispanic patients, Asian patients, Native American patients, right? They don't have that.
Right. We definitely need a little bit more granularity there.
And, you know, how does being a smoker influence whether or not you fill out a PROMS?
And if you stop smoking, will you fill out a PROMS more?
Right. It's a hypothetical question. It's a rhetorical question, rather.
What if you say you can't smoke until you fill out your PROMS?
Oh, good luck with that. But it's rhetorical. It doesn't.
It is rhetorical.
This is a marker for potentially socioeconomic status. or other socio-demographic characteristics, or even potentially educational level or things like that. And it all just kind of ties back to how engaged is the patient? Do they understand why this is being done? Do they understand the importance? Are they invested?
Right.
And that's why, you know, fewer years of education, it's not the fewer years. If you educated these patients more, they're not going to, you know, fill out the surveys better. It's just a marker for all of those factors and the level of understanding around those factors and the potential for investment in those factors.
Totally agree. Good information there, boys and girls, about those who are collecting PROMs. Now we're going to go to the Your Cases on Hold featurette, the bioburden associated with severe open tibial fracture wounds at the time of definitive closure or coverage, the bioburden study. This is by Boss et al. There's a visual summary and it's free for 30 days. This is looking at the metric group that we talked about in previous episodes of Your Cases on Hold. The deep infraction rates following high energy open lower extremity fractures range from 13% to 33%. And we know ANSEF is our favorite drug. It's the drug that pumps, the heart pumps to the bones, and it tries to prevent our infection. It's a first generation cephalosporin that provides coverage for methicillin sensitive Staph aureus, streptococci, and some gram negative bacteria, including E. coli, Klebsiella, and Proteus. This study was designed to identify the bioburden profile of high energy open tibial fractures at the time of definitive wound closure or coverage and determine the relationship to subsequent deep infection. I find this interesting just because I think it's we're going to look at all different culture rates. We're going to look at it when it's an open fracture. We're going to look at it when we're closing it. We're going to look at it if they come back again. So the idea here is that in theory, at the time of the last definitive treatment or wound closure or coverage or whatever, your wound bed should be clean at that point in time. If it is clean, then hopefully that is able to predict the ability to reduce the risk of infection. I think that's the thought process with this. But we don't actually have good studies demonstrating what type of organisms are present at the time of closure. So again, this is the METRIC study, the Major Extremity Trauma Research Consortium, with 646 patients from 39 trauma centers from October 2011 to May 2015, with high energy open tibial fractures requiring a second debridement surgery and delayed wound closure or coverage. This included Gustilo type 3 tibial fractures, plateau, shaft, or pilon fractures requiring a second debridement procedure following initial debridement, and stabilization or a traumatic transtibial amputation requiring delayed primary closure or flap coverage. Wound samples were obtained at the time of definitive closure and coverage and were cultured in a central laboratory. So while their own centers could collect samples and send them into their own, and they could take that data and add it to the study, they did send it to a central laboratory for analysis. Cultures were also subsequently obtained from patients who underwent a fracture site reoperation for deep infection, non-union flap failure, amputation, bone grafting, or any other complication that necessitated opening the original wound. There was no standard of treatment because this is over multiple different sites. It was a pragmatic study with 12-month follow-up. And they found that 32% of the wounds had a positive culture at the time of closure or coverage. Now, in the world of Kaiser Sose, this potentially could be a testable fact. Whether or not it actually becomes that, I'm not sure, but it's a thought process for that. A single genius was identified in 75% of those positive cultures, and there were multiple organisms or genera in 25% of it. Gram-positive cocci were the most identified. Staphylococci was the most common of the cultures, which is not surprising for orthopedic infections given skin. And 83% of these were coag-negative staph. Enterococci were identified in 13% of cultures, and gram-negative rods were identified in 50% of the cultures. The most frequent gram-negative were Enterobacter and Pseudomonas. Of these, you had 27% of the cohort had a subsequent reoperation. So of the whole cohort, 27% of the cohort had subsequent reoperation at the fracture site for a treatment of deep infection. And 154 had positive cultures, or 50% of the 310 revision surgeries. They identified a single genius in 55% of the samples, and again, 45% were multiple. So in the first part, three quarters were one single genius, and then one quarter were multiple genius. Now almost half of them were multi or polymicrobial at this point in time. So they've come back and they've been potentially reinfected with another organism. So they're polymicrobial, assuming that a lot of these patients probably received antibiotics and patients became infected or superinfected with other organisms. Gram-positive clusters were identified in 87% of the positive cultures. Again, staph again was the most common. Coag-negative staph was present in 22% of the cultures, and there was MRSA in this as well as MSSA. MRSA was 21%, MSSA was 26%. Again, we had enterococci at a very similar rate of 16%, streptococci in 10%, and they had gram-negative rods in 65% of them, predominantly Enterobacter, Serratia, and Pseudomonas. So, did have subsequent infection have any correlation with the positive culture at the time of wound closure or coverage? So patients who had that positive culture at the time of wound closure or coverage had a subsequent infection rate of 37%. But the infection rate was 22% in patients with a negative initial culture. So while they were statistically different, 22% versus 37%, there was still a high percentage of patients who had a negative initial culture at the time of wound closure that subsequently developed an infection. What were factors that had increased likelihood of developing a deep infection? The severity of muscle damage and the extent of wound contamination were associated with the risk of positive initial culture and the risk of developing a deep infection. An age of greater than 34 years and a BMI greater than 35 kilograms per meter squared were also factors associated with deep infection. So I've thrown a lot of numbers at you. I know that's one of those high things that they actually then looked at patients who had negative cultures. And there was a pretty high rate of negative cultures in this population. So what they did state is that one of those things is that some of these centers, again, these are not standardized practices. They can be only holding their cultures for 5 days, not enough time. So if you hold it for 14 days, you're more likely to get a positive culture. They did talk about genius. I would love to know species to know if it's the exact same organism that's being reinfected. And I think that's what the more important thing is. Like, are you not eradicating the infection the first time around when you're treating these high energy fractures? Or are patients becoming reinfected, as is suggested by the polymicrobial aspect of things? Or are we not culturing them enough in the first time around? And these polymicrobial organisms are all present actually in the initial factor of things. And the authors recommend changing our antibiotic regimen. And so the question is, do we really want to change our antibiotic regimen? Because staph was still the most common here. So ANCIF still makes the most sense. And there's multiple studies showing that ANCIF is actually really beneficial. My charge is actually the opposite way of things. Are we using too many antibiotics? Are we causing polymicrobial infection in our patients? And does giving a different prophylactic antibiotic at the time of definitive closure make an actual difference? Do we culture the wound earlier and then direct the antibiotic treatment based on that? And does that make a difference?
You know, an interesting study. You know what a Festschrift is?
Please tell me more.
So a Festschrift is like when someone like yourself is getting ready to retire, like someone very prestigious who has done a lot in the academic field, they will get like all of their like trainees or their trainees who went on to esteemed careers themselves, and they do like they put together like a book, a memory book of, you know, this is the catalog of all like the work that was done or was inspired by, you know, Dr. Antonia Chen amongst her trainees or colleagues. This is like a catalog. This is the Festschrift of the metric data, where they just, you know, sort of give you this rote breakdown of amongst their patients with these types of injuries, severe open tibial fracture wounds. Here's what it was like, you know, initially, and here's what it was like after. You know, they say that this is prognostic level 2. I think they're trying to leverage just the fact that the data was collected prospectively. Given that, you know, there's not very much that's done methodologically here, I would make the case that this is really just sort of a clinical retrospective of the catalog of organisms that they had present. And there's just like a lot of confounding and conflating factors, many of which are unmeasured or unknown, some of which you touched on, that really make it hard for me to sort of interpret this, other than to say, yes, you know, especially in these wounds, which are very distal, so exposed to a lot of bacterial shedding from places more proximal in the body, as well as nosocomial factors, the longer these individuals are in the hospital waiting for their repeat procedures, these wounds are being colonized. And there's probably some effects from the antibiotic regimens that they are there then on while in the hospital waiting for the definitive closure. But to kind of make heads or tails of that, I think is very challenging. Even in this group, I think they failed to capture samples from 25% of all the revision procedures. I think that's very telling. I didn't understand the end. I would have liked them to explain, you know, a little bit further, because they said, you know, based on the results, they're going to do a randomized trial. They might be doing a randomized trial on an antibiotic protocol. Like, I don't, like, shouldn't the antibiotic protocol just be like tailored to what
covers what's there? Right. That's the whole point of that. Yeah, exactly.
So, I mean, that's just like the last sentence of the study, but I was really just like, I don't like to see the words, this calls for randomized trial, in the last sentence of any study. I don't think that that's
for all those listening. Our deputy editor of methods does not want to see that. So please remove that from your text.
Usually, public service announcement. It's just a throwaway statement where they're just like, this needs to be studied in randomized controlled trials. Like, here, there is more meaning behind it, but it's just really kind of, you know, a major cliffhanger.
That's what it more feels more like.
Maybe it was intentional, maybe not, but nonetheless, that's what I have to say about that.
Perfect. Well, we've got a few more things to say about things here. We're talking about honorable mentions, preoperative hindfoot alignment, and outcomes after high tibial osteotomy for varus knee osteoarthritis. We walk on our heel, not our ankle, by Yang et al. It's free for 30 days. The hip to calcaneus axis, previously known as the ground mechanical axis, ideally passes through the center of the knee joint to the in the native knee. The aim of the study was to elucidate, with the use of hip to calcaneus radiographs, changes in knee and hindfoot alignment and changes in outcomes following high tibial osteotomy. The group with a preoperative fixed hindfoot varus deformity had a higher rate of undercorrection and worse clinical outcomes, especially pain, following high tibial osteotomy, although the findings may not be clinically relevantly different. Therefore, modifications of the procedure to shift the ground mechanical axis more laterally may be required for these patients. Next, we have surgically treated degenerative lumbar spine diseases in twins by Sigethi et al. And this study evaluated the heritability and concordance rates for lumbar spinal stenosis and lumbar disc herniation requiring surgery by studying monozygotic and dizygotic twin pairs. And the study found that genetic factors may play an important role in the risk of developing lumbar spine stenosis requiring surgery, but hereditary doesn't play as big of a role in lumbar disc herniation that undergoes surgery. Next, we have passive aversion assessment for progressive collapsing foot deformity after lateral column lengthening, a cadaveric biomechanical study by Kim et al. And the objectives of the study were to quantify the relationship between the maximum passive eversion in hindfoot joints following lateral column lengthening with plantar pressure during stance and determine the influence of wedge size on these outcomes. They found that decreased hindfoot eversion following lateral column lengthening was related to increased lateral plantar pressure during stance. Increasing wedge size correlated with decreasing passive hindfoot eversion and increasing lateral plantar pressure, suggesting that intraoperative preservation of eversion motion may be important for preventing excessive lateral loading. And finally, the accuracy of the lesser trochanteric profile as a marker of femoral rotation, computed tomography-based study of 1,722 femora by Jiang et al. And we know that the lesser trochanteric profile is often used as a marker for proximal femoral rotation, specifically when doing operative fixation of femur fractures. This CT-based study using the SOMA database of 56,826 lesser trochanteric profile measurements found that when the proximal femur is externally rotated, the lesser trochanteric profile becomes an unreliable marker of rotation, which can lead to excessive internal rotation of the distal fracture fragment. The lesser trochanteric profile should be used with caution, and confirmation of rotation by other means is recommended. So there you have it. Pay attention to anatomy. Pay attention to not saying randomized controlled trials are the next steps. And there we have it for today's episode. Thank you for being here, and we look forward to next time.